There was a farm across the road from Auntie Dorothy's. We used to go to a spring on this property, which had a nice little wooden bridge over it, and watercress, which we would gather and bring home for sandwiches. The farmer kept a baby bull in a cage by the barn. His teenage daughters used to feed him with a baby bottle. He was such a sweet little animal, we could never understand why Auntie Dorothy was so mortally afraid of bulls. We always went for a picnic at Sayward's Beach at least once during our holiday. The only way there was a long trek through bull-infested fields, everyone carrying something for our picnic. Auntie Dorothy and Mum had a fine time of it, being terrorized by fierce bulls. I could never understand why we had to go to Sayward's anyhow. The beach was not so sandy as Cordova Bay proper. There was no swings, no other children to play with, hordes of wasps, and worst of all, no McMorrins with the possibility of ice cream cones. Auntie Gladys was a part of these Cordova Bay adventures. She would hold a 2-week vacation Bible school class on the beach, having made a sort of shelter with logs and a canvas awning. We were required to show up every day, missing out on swim time, while she told Bible stories and taught crafts. She had a little portable organ, which she played when leading us in chorus. Jesus loves me, and wide is the ocean, high as the heavens above. Deep, deep as the deepest sea is my Savior's love. I, though so unworthy, still I'm a child of his care, for his word teaches me, and his love reaches me everywhere. This last, with appropriate actions, was my favorite. The vacation Bible school was a drag, on the whole, and I think the five of us made up the bulk of the enrollment. But it did have a glorious finale, a torchlight parade a la Hitler Youth, but with us marching around singing our choruses, holding wonderful Japanese paper lanterns with candles in them, suspended on bamboo poles. In later years, as we grew older, we started going on motor trips, all of us somehow crammed into Dad's little Ford and taking off for who knows where, always a high adventure. Dad was always so busy at the store all year that when he did take his annual 2 weeks vacation, usually in August, he threw himself into it with enormous zest. We might start off by taking the Black Ball Ferry, the Kalakala, to Port Angeles and mess around the Olympic Peninsula and Puget Sound, staying in auto courts along the way. Faith and Frank would have fun making outrageous comments about the place names we came upon. Sequim, Puluayap, Tulalip. We would drive for half a day, always ending up at a spot where we could get a good swim. I remember what a long way we had to go to finally get to the Pacific Ocean. The first time we'd seen it, I believe, at Nea Bay. And what a disappointment it was. A rather bleak, stony beach, where we weren't allowed to swim because of the undertow. Once we made a trip to the Okanagan, stopping at Oliver to visit an old school friend of Dad's, who had an orchard there. We traveled via the Fraser Canyon, which was not the safe highway it is today, but a very precipitous, winding, often gravel road hugging the side of a cliff. As we were driving on the outside curve of the narrow, winding road, we were obliged to inch out to the very edge of the chasm to let oncoming traffic, often a logging truck, pass, as there was nothing but steep cliff on the other side of the road. Mum was in mortal terror all the way. She kept threatening to get out and walk, taking us children with her. If Dad wanted to kill himself, that was his business, but she wanted none of it herself. Of course, her screams and shrieks only made Dad more daredevil. It's easy to see where Frank got his teasing ways. We had a hard time getting up some of the hills, too, of course. Everyone had to lean forward, and there was actually times when we had to get out and push the last few yards of a particularly steep slope. On another holiday on the Olympic Peninsula again, we discovered the Olympic Hot Springs, now closed because of a mountain slide. There was such an idyllic place that we'd return there next year with Granny and Auntie Gladys. Phyllis and Lillian and several assorted cousins and spent the whole holiday just basking in the beautiful waters. It was a lovely place, a large, hot spring, but not too hot. The open pool surrounded by green mountain slopes, with snow-covered peaks beyond, and eagles lazily circling overhead as you lay back in one of the many inner tubes available in the pool. The hit song on the jukebox that summer was Melancholy Baby, and it seemed to be playing all the time. We each got some spending money every day, so sampled the exciting American chocolate bars and all-day suckers. I was really cheesed off one day when the ants decided to climb the trail to the top of the mountain, taking everyone except me and Chris, who had to stay behind with Granny. Lucky Connie was first back down, whooping and hollering, having run all the way down the mountain. In later years, we often went on holiday up island. This meant driving over the dreaded Malahat, another occasion for palpitations from Mum. We could never determine where the exact summit was. Dad told us stories of driving the Malahat when he was a young man, when the road was even worse. Once we went to Alberni to visit Dad's cousin Norman and his family. They lived in a very inadequate house. It was not even painted outside. Mum thought this was disgraceful, but all the houses were the same in Alberni. "They've got the bush eye," said Dad, Norman's father. Dad's uncle, Harry, had been a pioneer in Alberni. He had come to Victoria at the time of the gold rush, done well breaking horses for use as pack animals in the Yukon, and later settled in Alberni, hiking in with all his belongings on his back. His son Norman had a wife, Auntie May, a plump, jolly Irish woman. They had an enormous family, mostly girls, one of whom was disturbingly cross-eyed, and one boy, Harry, my age, with a shock of red hair and torn pants. The older girls had attempted to bring some culture and finesse into their rough home. They had collected wooden spools from thread and strung them on wires to make a four-poster bed for their room. I immediately resolved to start saving spools. Anyhow, this family told Dad we should have a look at Sprout Lake, about 20 miles from town. So we made our way there. It was a lot further than 20 miles, the bush eye. We fell in love with the place and returned there for several years. We stayed in the usual auto court, but this time, because we are such a large family, we got to stay in a converted boathouse right on the shore of the lake. This was a great place. We could hear the water slapping under the veranda. There was a big wood stove, lots of comfortably sagging couches, and piles of ancient magazines, even jigsaw puzzles with tantalizing missing bits. We three little ones would fish off the docks for bullhead, which we sold to the owner for a nickel a canful. There were rowboats we were free to use, and we all learned to row there after a fashion. Sometimes Dad would send me to the store in the next bay to buy a newspaper. This was a long, arduous row, and I would be exhausted when I got back. Dad wanted the paper because this was August of 1939. At last, one day, he said we had to cut short our holiday and head home. There was going to be a war. The grown-ups were particularly worried because Granny and Auntie Gladwin's were in England that summer. Would they get home safely? On Labor Day of that year, the various branches of the Woodward family held a joint picnic at Ardmore, a lovely spot near Victoria. Smooth rocks and arbutus trees, leaning over the still water of Brentwood, the last swim of the year, but the adults were very worried and subdued, thinking of family in England, and of course, of cousins who were of an age to fight. With September came a new feel to the world. Even though we often had weeks more of warm, sunny weather, we were back in school with its smell of freshly oiled floors. We had a new pair of shiny black Oxfords, and summer was over. Mum always said this was her favorite time of year. Was this because it was her birthday month, or because her children were back in school? She could be found, when we got back from school, actually sitting on the front porch, doing nothing but relaxing. This was rather unsettling. Mum was always busy. She didn't take time off. A nice thing about autumn was the maple leaves that piled up on the path to school, especially at the bend. It was lovely to scrunch through them knee-high in crackling leaves. October brought Chris's birthday, always with a Halloween theme, and the excitement of Halloween itself. One year I went out dressed as a fairy, in someone's hand-me-down ballet tutu, arms and legs covered in goose flesh. Christmas was the high point of the year, of course. With us, it began officially on the first day of December. Since the store was so busy all month, this was the last time Dad could take any time off. Nothing would do, but we had to go out to the Souk Hills to get our tree. So this first Sunday after meeting and Sunday school, we all bundled up and piled into the car. We had to go for miles, it seemed, until we found the perfect stand of trees and chose the perfect tree. Faith was in charge here, pacing around each candidate tree, measuring up its good points. Finally, she'd made her selection, and Frank had the honor of chopping it down. Then we all took turns dragging it to the car, where Dad tied it to the roof. One year, we had a light snowfall on the way home, which certainly added to the Christmas spirit. As we tooled along, singing carols, another time it was so foggy that Frank had to run ahead of the car so Dad could see the road. Once we had the tree, of course, it had to be put up without delay. Here, also, Faith was in solo charge. Us three little ones could only watch from the doorway as she placed each ball in the exact right spot, and I swear hung each strand of tinsel individually. One year, Mum bought us each a ball of our own. Faith graciously allowed us each to hang our own ball, under her supervision, of course. Mine was a blown glass sailing ship, pink, with glass wire rigging. We used to be able to get fabulous ornaments handmade in Germany. With the onset of the war, of course, these were no longer available. Once the tree was up, shimmering silver in the living room, the Christmas season was really upon us, even though it was still only the first week in December. Connie and I had the dolls' concert to prepare. There was the school concert, and finally the Sunday school concert. Connie and I used to go out at night singing carols in the neighborhood, along with two or three friends. We were collecting money for some unspecified worthy cause, mostly financing our own Christmas shopping, I'm afraid. Some households didn't appreciate us, sending us away quite rudely. Others, even worse, made us come in and sing properly in their living rooms. Mum used to encourage us to make our own gifts, but I can't remember anyone showing much enthusiasm for this. I do have a picture of Connie and I having made the arduous decision to get Mum a tiny blue bottle of Evening in Paris perfume, waiting impatiently at the counter of the 15-cent store, carefully counted money in hand, while the clerk pretended she hadn't seen us. The dolls' concert kept me and Connie busy for weeks. The whole family had to attend the performance. Each doll had to recite or sing. We even decorated a miniature tree for them. The school concert was another event. One year, my class were gypsy dancers. All the girls wore bright-colored full skirts. Mine was pink, trimmed with rickrack braid, and carried a tambourine, which had lots of ribbons streaming from it, which we were to shake over our heads at appropriate moments in the dance. I just loved my tambourine. Alas, on the big night, I dropped it a few bars into the dance. What a disaster! In the end, I was able to get myself together enough to go through the motions without the tambourine, but not before I'd stumbled about the stage for several minutes trying to retrieve it from under people's feet. One year we put on a fairy tale pageant of some sort, and I had been chosen to be the fairy princess. I was puffed up about that. But measles intervened, and I didn't even get to see the play. A big part of the season was the Sunday school concert. Boring and exciting both. The children would arrive at the hall basement, where we would be served supper by our teachers. This was enormous platters of sandwiches and bread and butter and mug after mug of cocoa from big enamel pitchers. Later, the parents would arrive and we'd do the concert. Our family was always a major part of the program. We never got away without a long recitation. I remember Connie one year doing a particularly pathetic Edwardian poem about an insufferable child who wore a fur tippet, whatever that was, and wanting to go to heaven, put a stamp on his forehead, and rushed out to mail himself in the pillar box, only to be run over by a huge horse, thus getting an express delivery to the hereafter. She used to memorize this interminably in bed at night. Mum would coach us in the proper elocution, making us put lots of emotion into it. The concert would conclude with each child getting a brown bag with a Japanese orange and lovely striped peppermint candies of a sort we never got otherwise. When Christmas Day arrived, it was always a bit frustrating. We had our stockings in bed, but Dad had to go to the store to finish up late deliveries, and no presents could be opened until he got back. Plants and cut flowers, though ordered in advance, were not to be delivered until Christmas Eve, or preferably Christmas Day itself. So even though Dad had been terribly busy for days, there were always last-minute deliveries to be finished up. It was a wonder he ever got through the presents in Turkey. Boxing Day must have been heaven for him. One dreadful year, his regular delivery man, Bill Cave, could not do all the deliveries for some reason, and Dad had to hire a couple of high school students to do the late Christmas Eve run. Taking an order to one house where a party was going on, they were invited in and joined the party, leaving the truck full of plants and flowers shivering in the sudden frost. An hour or so later, they resumed their work, but by that time the flowers had all shriveled up with the cold. That meant the next morning irate customers were on the phone to complain, and Dad had to somehow replace all the orders himself. It was late afternoon before we were allowed to have even one gift. One year, Christmas Day fell on a Sunday. This was a disaster. Plymouth Brethren held that nothing was more important than observing the Lord's Day, and that religious observation of Christmas and Easter were mere popery, anyhow, and only the secular aspects of the holiday were allowed. Therefore, Sunday would be observed as usual in the usual way, and Christmas would have to wait for the next day. Loudly we protested. Surely Santa Claus made only one trip. What would happen to our stockings? But Mum was adamant. We had to wait. My friends had all had their tree and dinner. We felt horribly deprived. We went to Sunday school as usual. It just wasn't fair. Winnie Burge's family, though not allowed to have their tree until the next day, like us, had at least had lovely stockings to open that morning. Somehow we survived until the next day, and all was forgotten. Christmas didn't fall on a Sunday again for another 7 or 8 years, when we were all in our teens. Mum seemed to have forgotten the strict observance of Sunday for once, and we celebrated along with everyone else. On Boxing Day, there was always a beautiful children's party at Cloverly, organized by the aunts, at which the whole family got together. All the cousins and second cousins would be there. We were the Uncle Lawrences. There were also the Auntie Dollies, the Uncle Edmundses, and the Auntie Beths. Cloverly would be very festive for the occasion. One of the few times we would actually enter at the front door rather than the back entrance. The drawing room would be opened as well as the large dining room and the hall, and great fires crackled in every room. We saw people we hadn't seen since last year's party. One year it was decided to have real candles on the tree for one last time. It was a very tall tree set up in the hall, which was a large room in its own right. Dad was in charge of lighting the candles, which were fastened to the branches with clips, from which hung flocked glass balls in the shape of cabbage roses. Everyone was banished from the room while Dad lit the candles one by one. Then he opened the door, and for a few minutes we all crowded in to gaze in awe at the wonderful sight. It was a magical thing. Not only were the candles glittering and shimmering all over the tree, hundreds of them it seemed, but the smell of candle wax mixed with fir tree was unforgettable. It lasted only a minute or so, then the candles had to be quickly snuffed out and the magic was gone. At these parties we always played old-fashioned games like Spin the Bottle, Hunt the Thimble, and our own family version of charades, where the syllables were spoken, worked into the skits, not just mimed. Living in Victoria was a definite drawback if you wanted snow, which we did, desperately all winter. Save for a couple of exceptional years, we were lucky to get more than a day of it. More often we'd get bitter winds, ice-cold rain, and when it did turn into soft, airy flakes, it was likely to melt away as soon as it touched the ground. Will it settle, we'd ask ourselves, hoping against hope that this was our lucky day? When at last the miracle happened, Parkview Drive became the perfect sledding hill. One block long, as steep as could be wished, with hardly any traffic, it was ideal except for one drawback. The slope ended abruptly at busy Gorge Road. Consequently, when we went sledding, Mum would post herself at the bottom of the hill, ready to throw her body between us and the passing cars. Occasionally, we'd have a cold snap, which resulted in shallow lakes freezing over. Then somehow we'd find enough well-worn, hopelessly dull skates for the whole family, and we'd get a chance to try our luck on the ice. I remember Dad taking us one starry night to Swan Lake, where a crowd of people were skating around and there was a blazing bonfire on the shore, where we could warm ourselves up. Then when we got home, Mum had hot cocoa for everyone, and we'd take a brick, heat it in the oven to warm our beds delightfully. But winters were short in Victoria. The first snowdrops would appear in January, and suddenly we were anxious for the days to get longer and spring to arrive. There used to be thousands of Easter lilies growing wild in every wooded corner. At school, we used to vie for each other who would pick the biggest handful and bring back to the teacher after recess. The poor flowers would be wilted in minutes and never return next year. Now they are very rarely found, thanks in large to our efforts. In June, we would risk prickled arms to pick bunches of wild roses for Mum, her favorite flower. They grew abundantly all along the edge of the gorge. When the roses bloomed, we knew it wouldn't be long before we were swimming every day again.